It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll get a firsthand look at the effort to provide medical treatment in the midst of the Ebola outbreak from a Wisconsin healthcare worker who went to Sierra Leone.
First, an effort is underway in the state legislature to pass a so-called right to try bill, something six other states have already done and many other states are considering.
The bill would allow individuals suffering from terminal illness to pursue experimental drugs, devices, ones that have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration, as long as the patient has exhausted all other options and has the go-ahead from their doctor.
We're joined now by one of the lawmakers who introduced that bill. Fred Risser is a Democratic state senator from Madison. Senator Risser, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on today.
So tell us why you're introducing this right to try bill here in Wisconsin.
Well, I think it's a good public policy. After all, when a person is terminally ill, they have that opportunity to help society move ahead on drugs that have not yet been approved. And also, it gives them at least a little bit of hope that something might happen in their favor. It's strictly voluntary, and it's a bill that, as I say, I think is a good public policy. It gives the person who has already been informed that they haven't much life to live one more chance to help society and possibly help themselves.
Can you walk us through it a little bit, how it would work if someone wanted to try one of these experimental medications?
Well, first of all, he'd have to be designated as terminally, or he or she would have to be designated as terminally ill. In other words, there would be all reasonable expectations that their life would not last very long. And once they're determined to be terminally ill, they would be having an opportunity voluntarily to, if they're competent enough to, with written consent, try so-called experimental drugs. The pharmaceutical company would have to be making them available, and these drugs would definitely have to pass phase one of the FDA procedure. FDA goes through three phases. Phase one goes through the first safety phase. So it's a win-win situation.
Now, the FDA already has a process for helping very ill people receive unapproved treatments. Why not stick to that?
Well, they'd have to go through the approved treatments first. And after they've gone through all the approved treatments, if they've been designated as terminally ill, they could, if they wanted to, and if a pharmaceutical company was willing to use them as an experiment. Actually, this is the same experiment that's gone through before a drug is approved by the FDA, but it takes years sometimes to have the experiments completed. This would speed up the experiments. So as I say, it would be helpful to society, and it might be also helpful to the terminally ill patient. But I think it's in best public interest, and it's strictly voluntary.
Any concerns about liability? If the drug might actually harm the patient or maybe didn't work, would the law protect physicians, drug makers who might be on the line?
That is one of the purposes of the law. The law would protect the doctor that administered the drug, and it would also protect the pharmaceutical company that made the drug available. Now, let's remember that the patient has to be terminally ill, in other words, on the verge of dying, and the all the normal procedures have had to been tried.
Have you heard from constituents who are looking for a bill like this, who have wanted to try medications but been blocked?
Everyone I've heard from thinks it's a great idea. I haven't heard from anyone that opposes it. In talking to the medical society, though, they have some hesitation, and their hesitation is based on the fact that it might be giving someone false hope. It does. But if you're terminally ill and if you've been advised that your life is extremely limited, I don't see anything wrong with the idea.
Now, this is still a relatively new idea. Six states have passed right-to-try laws. Any stories from those states or lessons learned about how it's working there?
It's fairly recent. I've heard no problems, and 24 more states have got the bills in the hopper. So it's an idea that has apparently gained some support.
Now, in the past year or so, these right-to-try laws have been pursued by a group called the Goldwater Institute, a conservative advocacy organization that advocates for laws. So I guess the question is, here you are, a Democratic lawmaker pursuing this. So what's the connection?
I don't think this is partisan at all. Certainly, dying is not partisan, and use of drugs is not partisan. I think this is about as bipartisan as you can get.
Any feedback from physicians?
The only feedback I've gotten so far, they have not taken a stand, by the way, on this bill. The feedback is that it might give false hope, which I agree it might. But I've heard nothing from the medical society positively one way or the other.
Have you seen any support among your fellow lawmakers, Democrats or Republicans?
The bill's in circulation right now. I have a co-author in the Assembly, and several people have indicated they're ready to sign on to the bill. I'll know in a couple of days how many others will want to co-author it with me.
Now, some physicians around the country, I understand, have come out against these right-to-try laws, some of them saying it undermines the drug approval process, others saying that they could be prescribing drugs that they're not comfortable with. And you've said that a physician would have to sign off for it, but how do you respond to some of those criticisms?
Well, it would speed up the process and make experimental drugs hopefully usable sooner. And I can't see anything wrong with that. I think that's a good idea. Otherwise, sometimes it takes weeks, months, years in order to have a drug approved. This would speed up the process because you'd have more experimental use of it.
And any sense of a timeline on this so far?
Well, we're circulating a bill right now, and hopefully after the budget is passed, the bill will be hearing, and hopefully we'll get some action on it.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me today.
We've been speaking with Fred Risser, a Democratic state senator from here in Madison. Our next guest got a firsthand look at the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, stepping away from her work at a clinic in Wisconsin to work with the Ebola effort in Sierra Leone, where she'd worked as a Peace Corps volunteer in the past.
Lisa Varnes Epstein is back in the state now. She's a primary care physician assistant affiliated with Vernon Memorial Healthcare in Viroqua. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
So tell us, first of all, about your first experience in Sierra Leone with the Peace Corps. What were you doing? What were some of the health issues you were working on and the cultural issues that went along with them?
So I joined the Peace Corps in 1987 and was assigned to Sierra Leone as an ag volunteer. And ag volunteers typically were sent to the more remote sites to work with subsistence-level farmers. So we had 3 months of, let's say, language, cultural, and technical training, and then I was transferred upcountry to a very, very small, remote bush village of about 100 people in the northern district of Koinedugu, so it's not too far from the Guinea border. And then I got to live with the Karankos, which is one of the 13 ethnic groups in Sierra Leone. They're largely a Muslim tribe, and my job was basically to conduct a needs assessment of like a 3 to 4 village catchment area and then connect those farmers, men and women farmers, to in-country resources, which was a good start for me, particularly because I was born and raised in the Chicago suburbs and I was not exactly, I didn't have a background in agricultural, in the agricultural field. So I did grow a lima bean in kindergarten and somehow that got me qualified for being an ag volunteer. But the nice thing about it was that what we found out is we didn't have to be ag experts. What we needed to do was be able to connect farmers to in-country resources. And I was able to do that while learning a lot about farming in a rural area. So we started oil palm nurseries, obtained a pair of work oxen to help plow rice plots. We tried lots of different varieties, newer varieties of rice to try to extend the growing season. And rice is a staple in the diet there. And then I would say the 2-year experience, like most Peace Corps volunteers, was pretty formative and profound in so many different ways. I learned a lot from living with my Karankos family. They truly became my family, particularly with living in such a small village. And a lot of the things that I learned there, I think, influenced my life in the States and the way my husband and I chose to raise our 3 children. And he, incidentally, is also a returned Peace Corps volunteer and served on a super remote island in Micronesia. Mm. In terms of risk factors that I saw in the culture, the weak healthcare infrastructure was very, very evident at that time. There were no clinics in this entire district. The district hospital itself was just a couple of crumbling wards and rooms. Some didn't even have doors. Some didn't even have walls. And I remember seeing a few patients when I walked through once, and they told me they had tuberculosis. They didn't look well. I don't remember even seeing a provider around. And then what I found out was that the hospital itself was not viewed by the villagers as a place to go to receive medical care. It was a place that, in all likelihood, you would simply die there. So very, very few people from my village would ever access the hospital when ill, and then most of life and death pretty much unfolded in the village. Mm. So under those circumstances, what you see are deaths from what we would normally consider treatable conditions in the state, such as severe dehydration in young kids with diarrhea, malaria, typhoid. And then with so many resource-poor places, such as Sierra Leone and other countries, it's mostly the young, the old, the pregnant that were the most vulnerable populations and had the highest mortality rate.
Well, I want to jump ahead, Lisa, now. We've got this Ebola outbreak. Now you're a healthcare worker. What motivated you? What led you to want to go back and work on this Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone?
Well, I had had an opportunity to return to Sierra Leone in 2011 as a medical provider. So Michael and I had committed to returning to our Peace Corps sites at some point. And we created this opportunity to volunteer at a clinic in Kabala, the district town that I just kind of described in Koinadugu district. So we brought the family there and had spent about 3 months working there, and I was able to kind of see the difference in the healthcare system from the 1980s all the way until 2011. And while they had a new hospital, there still were very few supplies. The staff wasn't really paid regularly, and there were a lot of gaps in staffing. So I at least had a chance to re-familiarize myself with Sierra Leone, with the culture, and then renew my my latent Creole, which is the it's a pidgin language. It's a combination of the King's English and Portuguese, and it's the common language that unites all the tribes. So I'm fluent in Creole, and I was able to kind of reestablish that during that time. So it was very helpful once I returned as an Ebola healthcare worker to already have that up and running and intact. So that was nice.
So for a lot of us, hearing about Ebola, it's something happening to people we don't know in a foreign country. What was going through your mind, given that this is happening to people you considered family?
Well, of course, I mean, the initial concern and worry, particularly because things were spreading so quickly, so fast, and so unchecked, back in the last spring and into the summer. Fortunately, I knew Koinadugu District had closed its borders, which is not an easy thing to do in a country where so many of the routes to get from one place to another are simply bush paths. But we knew that Koinadugu District had been spared and that most of the epicenter of the epidemic was down in the southeastern part of the country, sort of where Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone intersect. So that part, we were feeling pretty confident that our friends that we had established there were not affected. And that actually remains true to today, which I'm really glad to report.
So as a healthcare worker working in the midst of this outbreak, what were you doing? What was your day like?
Well, maybe I could just kind of take you up to the sort of training we had, because then that leads up to what I actually ended up doing. Mm-hmm. And that is basically, so we all had to be trained as Ebola healthcare workers through the World Health Organization in Freetown. So I was brought in as a cohort of about 15 medical providers. We were trained in putting on or donning and then removing or doffing personal protective equipment, the PPE, those spacesuits people see on TV. And after that initial training, then we were all transported upcountry to the Mafourke Ebola Treatment Unit. And then we underwent intensive hot zone training or red zone training, and that's where you're actually having exposure to patients that are being treated for Ebola. And this was a very graduated training. So initially we would just suit up and go through the unit, observe what was going on in the unit. The next time we would go in, we could provide some basic care. And then as we became more comfortable with moving in the units, being able to hear while you're in the PPE, we could start rendering advanced care. And then there was a huge emphasis on being competent in safety protocols. So we all had to complete that training, basically pass the test that we were safe, that we wouldn't put any of our colleagues at risk. And then I was assigned to the more remote district of Kono, which is more on the eastern side of Sierra Leone near the Guinea border. And PIH, Partners in Health, was working on a number of different sites in that area. One of them was the Community Care Centers, or CCCs, and these are centers that are functioning as upcountry gatekeepers. So if anybody was sick in a remote area, the idea was that they could come to the CCC, be screened for Ebola, and then hopefully if they were Ebola negative, then we could maybe treat them for whatever they did have. And we instituted the Hastings Protocol to be able to do that. So that meant we would not only test for Ebola, but we could also give anti-malarial medication. We could also give antibacterial medication. We could also do fluid resuscitation. And we all, you probably have heard in the media that an Ebola patient can lose up to 10 liters of fluid per day. Mm. That's 2.5 gallons, to those who are not familiar with liters, 2.5 gallons of fluid. And so fluid replacement is still the most important component of treatment, whether you're in an Ebola treatment unit or upcountry in one of the CCCs.
Now, providing this kind of care, obviously in the worst case, a lot of people passing away from Ebola. How was it emotionally to be there in the midst of this thing that the rest of us are just reading about back at home?
I think for me, because I, having had the experience I did in Sierra Leone back in the 80s, and then again, actually on two different occasions, in 2011, and then working with traditional birth attendants, I think that Sierra Leoneans have been one of the most vulnerable populations in the world when it comes to just having such a weak healthcare system, and they've been dying for a long time. And so you can talk about people who are piling up in Ebola treatment units and who are dying such terrible, tragic deaths, but Sierra Leoneans have been dying from treatable diseases for a long time. They've been living with this for a long time. And so for me, I had to kind of reconcile the idea of trying to work very hard at trying to prevent infection or recognize an Ebola infection as soon as possible so that we could initiate treatment. But my focus was also on the fact that there were other people, the collateral damage of Ebola, the people who were not being treated because people were afraid to treat anyone who was bleeding, let's say, from a trauma or a child that had a fever from something else. And so for me, it all kind of became a mix of either just attending to the Ebola victim or simply attending to somebody who would die anyway if we didn't give them an anti-malarial medication.
Do you have a message for the world, something you've learned there, you've seen there, that you want the rest of the world to know about this or other diseases in the region?
I think I definitely want people to realize the level of collateral damage that's happened with Ebola and that Ebola has killed an unacceptable number of West Africans. But the collateral damage and deaths is enormous. It's very, very difficult to measure, and it's not something that's really brought to light in the media. Hospitals and clinics closed. Healthcare providers weren't willing to show up sometimes. And people, the death rate from those conditions is thought to far exceed the Ebola death rate. And then the other thought is I want people to remember that even though we talk about expat heroes as heroes or expat Ebola health workers as heroes, but we talked a lot about this in-country, and no one was particularly comfortable with that idea. We all knew that we were humanitarians. We were educated in a country where such opportunities were far more available. But the real, real, real heroes are the Sierra Leoneans, the Liberians, the Ghanaians, who, despite being ostracized or shunned from their own villages out of fear that they will bring the infection to the village, they continued to come to work every day at these treatment units. They came as nurses and safety workers and burial team workers, and they placed not only their own life at risk, but also their social network safety net. And Sierra Leone is a country where commitment to the community or extended family or tribe is more important than individual advancement. So the national healthcare workers, the nationals, the host country nationals are indeed the real heroes of the Ebola response. And I'd like people to keep that in mind.
Well, Lisa, thanks for joining us. And hero or not, thank you for the work you've done there.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
That was Lisa Varnes-Epstein, primary care physician assistant affiliated with Vernon Memorial Healthcare in Viroqua, talking about her experiences providing healthcare during the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone. We're talking about Angelina Jolie Pitt's op-ed piece in the New York Times today.
2 years ago, the actress and filmmaker went public with her choice to have preventive double mastectomy. Today, she shared that she had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed due to a risk of cancer.
Dr. Lisa Barillette is with us now to talk about the risks and benefits of preventive surgeries when it comes to cancer. She's an assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison. She specializes in gynecological cancer. Dr. Barillette, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, looking at Angelina Jolie Pitt's story, two years ago, she got that double mastectomy because she tested positive for a BRCA1 gene mutation and had a family history. So what is this gene mutation? Why are we watching this so closely?
Sure. Well, I think Angelina Jolie brought a lot of attention to something that's actually been known about for a few decades now. And what BRCA is, it's a gene that encodes proteins that are responsible for DNA repair. As you can imagine, cells that aren't being cross-checked for appropriate DNA repair might not reproduce normally, or cells that aren't functioning correctly may become cancerous. So patients who have this gene have a much higher risk of certain types of cancer. And there are two separate genes that have been identified, BRCA1, which is the one that Angelina Jolie has acknowledge that she has, and BRCA2, which both have a higher risk of breast and ovarian cancer in particular, but have slightly different risk profiles.
How common are these two gene mutations as far as we know so far?
Yeah, so that's actually something that we're learning more about every month. But there are certain populations, worldwide populations, that have a higher risk. In the Ashkenazi Jewish population, it is higher, and you can see quotes as high as 1 in 20 patients being affected. Now, in the U.S. population, it's much more uncommon to have a BRCA mutation.
So if I understand things correctly, if you have one of these mutations, it doesn't mean for sure you're going to get one of these forms of cancer. If you don't have this mutation, you're not safe. You could still get breast or ovarian cancer. How much of a difference does this make as far as a risk factor goes?
Sure. I think it's really important to underscore the point that most ovarian cancers and most breast cancers are happening in women with no family history and no documented evidence of any type of genetic mutation. So not having this mutation certainly does not mean you're not at risk. To answer your question, BRCA1 patients have about a 60% chance of developing breast cancer by the end of, ovarian cancer by the age of 70, and about a 60% chance of developing breast cancer by that same age. For BRCA2 patients, the risks are slightly lower. They quote between a 15 and 20% risk of developing ovarian cancer, and a little bit lower, about a 50% chance. So less likely than BRCA1 to develop breast cancer.
So in someone in Angelina Jolie's case, I mean, that's a very high risk of breast cancer, of ovarian cancer, and it was common in her family. So is it common or getting more common for someone in that situation having this BRCA1 and a family history to go and get a fairly obviously significant preventive surgery?
It is becoming more common, I think, as this is so individualized. I mean, there are many patients who have these mutations who don't do anything, who don't do any surgeries, who don't do any additional screening and live happy, normal lives. I think that's not recommended, but certainly an option. I think that Angelina Jolie brought a lot of attention to this issue, and I do have more patients asking me questions about these surgeries. But truly, patients, when they're diagnosed for BRCA, hopefully are under the care of someone who's also offering psychological support, offering opportunities for them to reach out to family members to talk about this diagnosis, and really helping them individualize their treatment. There are so many ways, other than surgery, that you can potentially lower your risk. It's important that we don't focus on surgery being the only solution. It's an option, and I very much respect Ms. Jolie's decision to choose that option and to bring attention to this condition. On the other hand, that doesn't mean that every woman with this diagnosis needs to have these surgeries.
We're talking about breast cancer and ovarian cancer risk and treatment options with Dr. Lisa Barillette from the UW-Madison. Dr. Barillette, I wanted to ask you about that. Those other options, what other kinds of treatments are common for people with these gene mutations that put them at this higher risk of ovarian cancer, of breast cancer?
So let me answer the breast cancer question, because I think that's a little bit more straightforward. We have really excellent screening tools available for breast cancer. So that doesn't reduce risk, but we actually are pretty good in high-risk populations at detecting that early. So for breast cancer risk, you actually can get an MRI, which is a relatively new technology being used for this, in addition to a mammogram annually. And that's not perfect, but pretty darn effective at finding early breast cancers. For ovarian cancer, we don't have a screening test that's nearly as good, but we do have some ways of reducing risk that can be helpful. Simply using birth control pills has been shown to reduce the risk of ovarian cancer. If you've used pills at any time over your lifetime for a total of 5 years, that can reduce your risk by almost one half. And that's something that many women have done without even recognizing that it was reducing their risk. Other things that can be done to reduce risk are surgeries that don't make you menopausal. Removing the ovaries, obviously, in younger women is going to reduce or negate their estrogen levels. In women who aren't ready to be menopausal but have completed childbearing, you can actually remove fallopian tubes and expect a decreased risk in ovarian cancer.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, most of the women who get breast cancer and or ovarian cancer don't have these mutations we're talking about. Are we getting better at assessing risk for women without these mutations, how likely they might be to get these forms of cancer?
For ovarian cancer, there are certain things that put you at slightly higher risk, but there are behaviors that you're unlikely to change just for the sake of reducing your ovarian cancer risk. For example, being pregnant, the more pregnancies you've had, puts you at a lower risk for developing ovarian cancer. I mentioned oral contraceptives or birth control pills. Breastfeeding for long periods of time actually has been shown to reduce your ovarian cancer risk. Nothing is enough that one would change their behaviors and personal preferences just for that, but certainly there, it seems that having more children and frankly not ovulating, right? That's the whole commonality here. Oral contraceptives make you anovulatory while you're taking them, and most women who are breastfeeding exclusively don't ovulate. When you're pregnant, you're obviously not ovulating. So it seems that those common behavior patterns can be helpful in reducing risks.
Now, the kind of surgery we've talked about, a double mastectomy, removing ovaries and fallopian tubes, that's not something I'm guessing that's going to be common in people who don't have this BRCA mutation as a preventive measure, I should say.
Absolutely not. I think it's very... ovarian cancer, fortunately, in the general population is pretty rare. It's not one of the most common cancers we see in women. You are much more likely as a middle-aged woman to have problems with heart disease, to have problems with diabetes, to have breast cancer still, unfortunately, much more common. So ovarian cancer is for most women, something pretty low in terms of lifestyle modification that they need to be concerned about. So then to even think about surgery, which is more morbid and carries its own set of risks, I am not recommending that in patients outside of very strong family histories or a known genetic mutation.
We heard from Amy on Facebook. She said, I did have these risk-reducing surgeries, and I found the information and support I needed through the whole process, decision-making, surgery, adjusting to a new normal, from an amazing organization called FORCE, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered. You had mentioned earlier, Dr. Berlette, support from family, social support. How important are support groups like this for people going through different types of cancer and treatment?
I think this is incredibly important. You're talking about young women, and in some of the more dramatic stories that you hear, it's women who had a sister or aunt or family member that perhaps they didn't even have a close relationship and get a phone call one day saying, hey, there's a BRCA mutation in the family, or hey, someone just got diagnosed with a breast cancer and we've learned about this. And so this information is being placed on their shoulders when they're in their early 20s. They're not thinking about necessarily having kids yet or starting their families, and now they're being told you may have a high risk of ovarian cancer or breast cancer, and these surgeries may be necessary. I think for those patients and for any patient going through this, it's imperative that they're talking to other people going through the same thing. It's such a unique set of circumstances. There are a lot of online support groups here at the UW Cancer Center. Our health psychologists work with patients with this diagnosis all the time, and we have Cancer Center support groups focused on young patients either with cancer diagnoses or with genetic mutations.
We're talking to Dr. Lisa Barillette about cancer risk and preventive surgeries in the wake of Angelina Jolie Pitt's announcement that she had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed.
And we're taking your calls. What do you think about preventive surgery when it comes to the risks of cancer? Would you have preventive surgery if you knew that you had a high risk of cancer? And do you think it's a good idea to get these blood tests? And what about Jolie's decision to share her story with the world? Call in and share your thoughts and your experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Dr. Lisa Barillette about preventive surgeries tied to Angelina Jolie Pitt's announcement that she had her ovaries and fallopian tubes removed due to cancer risks.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been tested for this genetic mutation, the BRCA1 or 2, to see if you are at a higher risk of breast cancer or ovarian cancer? Would you want to know if you're at this kind of higher risk? Have you been through some kind of preventive procedure? Made a lifestyle change in response to a higher cancer risk? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. Dr. Barillette, are we seeing more people go out and ask to be tested for BRCA variants, especially in the light of Angelina Jolie's previous surgery and op-ed piece?
I would be interested in asking my colleagues who see healthy women for annual exams that question, because I suspect they are. When patients are in my clinic, it's many patients who have either been already diagnosed with this mutation or have a very strong family history. So I think the piece of that population I'm seeing is a little bit skewed, and most of them have already appropriately been tested.
And we're not seeing this as a general recommendation for women at this
point? No, not right now. If you review, anyone can hop online and look at the National Comprehensive Cancer Center Network, the NCCN guidelines. They're accessible to the public, and they have recommendations on who should be screened for BRCA. I won't rattle them all off. It's a long list. But essentially, people who have a personal history, so they themselves were diagnosed with breast cancer at a young age, premenopausal, less than 45 years old, or have a personal history of ovarian cancer. Those patients should be tested. And if you have more than one close blood relative with breast cancer at any age, so there's a pattern of breast cancer or ovarian cancer in the family. There's a number of other guidelines, but that's kind of, you're looking at either parents who were affected with a breast or ovarian cancer, siblings, or if your own child was affected. Really close relatives would put you at a higher risk for this mutation.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Stacy with us in Madison. Stacy, hi.
Hi. My question is, how do I talk to my doctor about getting tested? And is testing generally covered by insurances?
And Stacy, actually, before I let our guest answer, if I may ask a personal question, is there a strong family history in your family of these kinds of cancer we're talking about?
My mother died of ovarian cancer.
Well, I'm sorry, but that's interesting. Dr. Barillette, first of all, is she someone who would be likely to be tested? And if so, how would she get the ball rolling?
Yeah, so you should definitely bring up testing with your physician, and that can be a primary care doctor or an OBGYN, whoever you see for your annual care. And usually what they do, many providers here in Madison are very comfortable ordering this testing, and we would do, insurance is a different story, but usually in patients with a family history, we are able to get this testing covered. Here at our cancer center, we have a policy that patients who are being tested, meaning having the blood test, and that's what this is, a tube of blood being drawn and tested for this mutation, if they are undergoing that, they also need to participate in genetic counseling. And that's more than a blood test. It's meeting with a genetic counselor to carefully review your family history, look for any other things that you may be at risk for, because there are other familial syndromes that can increase cancer risk. And we don't want to assume everything is BRCA when, in fact, something else may be occurring in the family. So it's a little bit more extensive and also offers additional support. Insurance companies do vary on whether or not they pay for genetic counseling. So we do work with patients to help find a way to get that covered or other funding mechanisms. But you, Stacy, you are someone who should you should definitely talk to your physician about being tested, and you would qualify for testing, and I think that's a very reasonable thing to do.
Stacy, thanks for calling, and good luck as you move ahead with this. Well, Dr. Berlet, I wanted to ask about, back to everyone else now, the people who don't have this genetic marker that we're watching for. I know there's a lot of controversy about when, how early, how often to start getting breast cancer, in particular screenings. What's the current state of the art now?
Yeah, so for breast cancer screening, you're right that most those guidelines are a moving target. For patients who are considered high risk, we do start screening early, meaning in their 20s. And I, the latest is to start mammograms over the age of 45, and in some patients are even delaying until 50. And those, I think, we're going to see constant updates, and different professional societies are going to recommend different things. So you'd need to have a personalized discussion with your provider. I think everyone's doing things a little bit differently. But for ovarian cancer screening, that's a lot more tricky, as I suspect you're about to ask me.
Yeah, what kind of screening is there? You said there's not perfect a screening method for ovarian cancer.
And there's not. And even for high-risk patients, we frankly don't have anything particularly reliable to offer. So even in, a patient like your last caller who has a family history and probably, someone who's tested positive for BRCA who probably should be getting some kind of screening, the best we can do is offer a blood test, which is called a CA125, and an ultrasound. That's a way of examining the ovaries. And that is, again, the NCCN, who I rely upon to provide us with pretty good objective guidelines, doesn't even recommend that strongly. The recommendations they give us are you could consider doing those tests, because they've never been shown to improve survival from ovarian cancer or detect ovarian cancer early enough to make a difference.
As we wrap up, Angelina Jolie Pitt has us talking about this. Is this good that people are watching for these genetic markers, thinking about these decisions, or are you worried that it's generating more fear maybe for people who don't have that much to worry about right now?
I don't worry about people becoming afraid. If someone's going to, I hope that our patients and the public will think about all the other things they can be doing for their health and only worry about this in the cases of a really strong family history where there's clearly a valid concern, or in cases where, you've already dealt with every other health concern that's so much more likely to be an issue, and you're wearing a seatbelt and your bicycle helmet and you're not smoking and you're exercising. There's just so many other things that are much more likely to cause problems as we age than ovarian cancer.
All right, we'll leave it there. Dr. Berlet, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Dr. Lisa Berlet. She's assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at UW-Madison, talking about preventive surgery and cancer risk after the publication today of an op-ed by Angelina Jolie Pitt, talking about her experience and the preventive surgery she elected to have.
In the second installment of our series on dental care, WPR looks at how Madison is working to get dental care to those who often need it most but can least afford it. It's hoped that connecting them to a dentist will mean emergency room doctors see fewer patients with tooth problems. Shemaine Mills reports.
This year, 54-year-old Frank Marshall did something he'd never done before. He went to a dentist.
Well, I heard about it through the shelter, and up here they pulled a tooth a few weeks ago, and now they're here to do clean-up work on other cavities.
Marshall stays at a local homeless shelter. He said he was in pain for about a month, but he never went to the ER. That's because he got care at the Madison Dental Initiative, where Dr. Benjamin Farrow is finishing up another patient and putting away dental tools.
He came, the tooth is out. The nerve in the tooth has been cleaned out.
Madison Dental Initiative is located inside the Salvation Army, which donated space so doctors could offer free care to those who can't afford it. MDI Executive Director Aaron Warren says about 1,000 kids and adults were seen last year by 40 area dentists.
We volunteer anywhere between 4 hours on the low end per month, all the way up to 20 hours. Then we have the remaining balance, 11 or so dentists that see patients at their own offices.
The clinic now has 3 dental chairs. It started 5 years ago with just one. And back then, the clinic was just for emergencies, open only on Thursdays.
you know, we have our normal business hours, but Thursdays are our extreme dental day, I like to call it, because we start seeing patients in the evening starting around 6 o'clock, and we don't leave until the last patient's done.
Every dental patient seen at MDI is one fewer potential patient in the local ER. Deborah DeNewer is dental health coordinator with Public Health Madison in Dane County. She and others have been working to divert patients with dental pain who come to the ER.
It's a big cost, and it's a poor use of the resources there, that unless someone is to the point of being really emergent, in which case that's exactly where they should be.
Problem is, ER docs aren't dentists, and DeNewer says it wasn't only the patients who were in distress when someone came in with tooth problems.
When someone comes to you for help and you cannot provide treatment that is going to take care of the real problem that someone has come to you for, it's a horrible feeling.
DeNewer and others set out to standardize how dental patients are treated in the ER. For instance, what antibiotics are best for infected teeth and what pain medication should be used. The community is trying to reduce the use of opiates, and DeNewer says research shows that opiates are not the best medication for tooth pain.
There are other things that work better, ibuprofen and Tylenol.
The ongoing effort to standardize tooth care in the ER and divert those patients to more appropriate, less expensive care appears to be working. In 2010, dental patients at Madison's four area emergency rooms peaked at more than 2,500. But last year, the numbers dropped to 1,900.
You can't say that it's one thing. There's all kinds of variables. But the fact that MDI was growing.
DeNewer also credits federally funded clinics in the area in helping divert dental patients from emergency rooms. But often there's more demand than supply, and DeNewer says people in need don't know which doors to knock on to find one that will open up. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, in the final installment of our series on dental care, Shemaine Mills looks at why people may be going to the emergency room when they should be going to the dentist.